Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. As always, I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today we're going to talk college basketball. So if you read what I write on Sports on Earth or browse my archives, you might think my interest in college sports begins and ends with off-the-field stuff. The NCAA, amateurism, concussions. But no, I actually do love the sports themselves. When I'm not reading NCAA depositions in the O'Bannon lawsuit, which, by the way, trust me, are very entertaining, I am watching games. Still, I wanted to hear from an expert. So today's guest is Nicole Auerbach. She's a college basketball writer for USA Today. Nicole, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the season so far, I have a general question about covering college hoops from a national standpoint, because geographically, the sport is so spread out. There are good teams everywhere. I could see you could be at Gonzaga one night and at Florida the next. And there seems to be a game of national or semi-national interest almost every night. I'm wondering, from your perspective, how do you stay on top of sort of the big and obvious national stories, but still find a way to uncover those less-known stories that people aren't talking about, but should be talking about?
It's hard. You're right about the travel. I mean, last year I did go out to Gonzaga and went to Oregon and Florida and Miami and all over, and this year already have seen, all the freshmen play and went out to Lawrence, went to Durham. You can go somewhere all the time, and we don't always travel just for games. So you got to have stories you want to do as well. So it just kind of forces you to dig and figure out, storylines at the big schools and the big players that people want to read. But also, as you're saying, like these smaller kind of like stories that you need to uncover a bit. I use Twitter for that. You pick up stuff by following beat writers or, random people who cover the sport or write about the sport who, find interesting nuggets about stuff. You can, sometimes people just assistant coaches or SIDs just talking about things. But yeah, that stuff's harder to find when there's 350 college basketball teams. A lot can slip under the radar. So that's definitely the challenge.
Well, you mentioned all that travel. What is, do you actually have to do all your own travel? Is there someone that helps you with that? Like, that seems like that could take a lot of your time just by itself. Just the logistics of setting things up.
No, yeah, we do our own travel. It has to get approved, but yeah, we have to figure it all out and flights and hotels and all that stuff. So yeah, it can take a while, but you gotta get those Marriott points. So
Of course. I'm actually in a Marriott right now on assignment, so I know all about that, although I don't travel nearly as much as all of you do. When you're in season, this is a kind of related question. When you're actually in season, do you ever feel like I am totally on top of this beat, or do you always feel like I am scrambling just to keep up with the pace of the calendar here?
No, I mean, I think it's just a 6-month period where life is crazy. And as you were saying, there are games every night, every day. I mean, especially it's holiday weeks, it's all day, all night. And so there's always something you can be doing. There's always someone to talk to, always some story going on. So sometimes the only thing you just worry that you're it was a great story, but you were doing 10 other things and you kind of maybe missed, contributing on something else. So it's just a lot. I don't think it's not like scrambling or like treading water. It's just understanding that, we have a national audience. So you just have to prioritize what what our audience is most interested in and what our editors are and that sort of thing. And just know that you can't get to everything. But, there's always games to watch. There's always people to talk to. You can always feel like you know what's going on with the sport, even if you can't get to write, the 20 stories a week that you think are worthy of a story. So it's just kind of prioritizing. And again, at the end of the day, just figuring out like, okay, is this a big deal? Is this something our readers want to read about? And going from there.
How many years have you been on the beat now?
This is my second year as a reporter. My first year was like I was a digital producer and blogger, so I didn't travel, but I was like essentially having to keep up with everything, and I was doing interviews and stories and stuff, but I wasn't on the road. So this is it's more demanding, and there's a lot more just kind of responsibility on like confirming things and reporting things and filling the paper and a lot of different areas and covering games and all of that. But it's great to get to interact with people in person and do the stories in person. It's much better, and you get much more out of the actual human to human interaction instead of
Right.
a phone.
No, that's something I always, I taught a journalism class last semester at Georgetown. I guess it'd be 2 semesters ago now. And that was one of the big things I try to emphasize to these kids was when you can, you've really got to be there. There's no substitute for that. Even if it's just hanging around, I'm sure, even so far as season, I'm sure there are some stories that either you've done already or that you're going to do that you weren't planning that probably just came from being in the right place at the right time, just from hanging around and seeing something.
Oh yeah, exactly. I mean, that's how you get some of those kind of off the wall story ideas, or just even like a good nugget for a feature. It's just by hanging around, small talk, and somebody offers something or mentions something in passing, and you're like, oh wow, that's really interesting.
So the big story this season, the big obvious story, moving away from nuggets for a second, at least heading into conference play, has been this freshman class that's coming this year, and that's what everybody's been talking about. I want to get your impressions because I think, have you seen pretty much all these guys play in person at least once? So I want to go through some of them and get your impressions. We'll start with Jabari Parker at Duke. When did you see him play? What was your impression?
Well, I've seen him play the most because I've seen Duke play 3 times in person already. I saw the champ I was at the Champions Classic, so I saw Parker Williams Randle, and then I saw Duke play Arizona at the Garden, so I saw Aaron Gordon as well. And then I saw Duke play Michigan when I was down doing a Jabari Parker story. So I think he's, everyone talks about his versatility, and I think that that's probably where you start with him. And it's interesting, I talked to a lot of people at Duke about him and his game, and they're trying to get him more touches in the post, and they want him to like develop a post game to make him even more versatile and essentially make him unguardable for especially for college players. Because he's doing that, like right now they can sort of drift out, they know he can shoot on the perimeter, but if he becomes a threat essentially everywhere on the court, and we already know, he can bring the ball up, he can go coast to coast, then it just becomes impossible, and you have to double him all the time and all these other things. So they're trying to make him even more versatile. But yeah, I mean, he's, one thing with all these, and I haven't spent too much time with Julius Randle, but these freshmen do seem really grounded, and like they've grown up with this hype. And but Parker's a really good example. They really don't seem to get rattled by it, and like by the attention. They don't get full of themselves, they don't read about themselves. So those are also good qualities that I think a lot of these freshmen have too.
So one question you're talking about there, Duke is trying to get him to play inside. Isn't that, looking ahead in a conference play and even into March, Duke's going to need that, right? They don't really have an inside presence right now. At least I've only seen a couple of games, but that's what stood out to me against Arizona. It was that if they, it was kind of the almost classic what Duke has become in the last 10 years, where if they're not hitting their threes or the driving lanes are closed, they really struggle sometimes on offense.
Well, I think the Arizona game was kind of a unique situation because not Arizona's length and size is like so much. It's their obvious strength, but they're going to be obviously the toughest team, and like that was probably the toughest matchup Duke could have had. And they actually were pretty pleased how they handled it afterwards. But you're right. I mean, they're going to need Parker to do that because in the early games they almost lost to Vermont. It was all the same sort of problems. It was their play in the paint, and also defensively, which they're working on too. But like a lot of that stuff is they're still young. Like their two best players did not play on the team last year, and Jabari Parker and Rodney Hood, who was transferred. So they'll figure that stuff out. But yes, they're definitely gonna need to figure out ways to go through the post in conference play. But I mean, I'm still high on them. I know they've had some dips and high points, but I think that they'll figure it out. And I also don't necessarily think the ACC is as daunting as we had been told all preseason. So I think they'll end up just fine during conference play.
Let's get to Wiggins because obviously Andrew Wiggins has been, he was coming into the season, for a whole good year and a half before this season, even maybe 2 years. He was the really hyped high school guy. And so far, he's looked somewhat like advertised. I mean, he's been incredibly athletic, moves that'll just kind of take your breath away. And you think, okay, this guy is not only an NBA player, but like a potentially incredible NBA player. But also seems to be a guy that is, to a large part, sort of blended in at Kansas at times. And I don't know if that's what they want him to do, or that's his personality, or if that is sort of the way Kansas plays. And in some ways, remind me a little bit of what we saw from McLemore last year, where sometimes you almost watch and think, why isn't this guy taking over a little bit more? But again, I don't know if that's intentional. What's your impression of Wiggins and sort of what he's done so far and what they want out of him on the floor?
Well, I agree. Athleticism is, the main thing that people bring up with him, and that's the part, NBA executives love, and obviously with all these guys, they're so young, but the potential is what people draft on and everything. But I think, part of it, I think you're on the right track with the aggressiveness that he's not taking over the games, and he has at times. I mean, in the Champions Classic, which was actually a fantastic, like, kind of opening night for the season, and all the freshmen somehow managed to live up to these insane levels of hype. But Wiggins hadn't most of the game, and then he took over right at the end, and he had a shot and then a dunk that sealed the game for Kansas over Duke. And so he showed that he can do that, and he's shown it in games since. Obviously, Kansas has lost a few games, a couple surprising losses, but they're still really young too, and they're, they have Joel Embiid, they have Perry Ellis, they have other really good players around him. So, when you look at like Aaron Gordon at Arizona, he's going to be one of the most important pieces on that team, but his numbers aren't going to, he's not going to score 20 points a game. He's going to have like 12 and 10, 12 and 8, and that's exactly what Arizona needs from him. Now, Kansas, you could argue, needs more from Wiggins on a nightly basis, but I think they have enough talent around him that he doesn't have to always be the go-to guy. And so I'm not too concerned. I know some people are, and I think some people just kind of like to nitpick these guys, and they're still literally in their first, 11, 12 games as college players. So I think conference play will be a really good test for Wiggins, because we need to see if he can kind of step up, be aggressive on like a nightly basis, not just for the big games. Because non-conference play, you go up and down. You're playing some really good teams and some not so good teams. And conference play, you got to get up all the time. And the Big 12 has some really good teams in it. So I think that'll be a really good test for him. But yeah, with him, the key is just is aggressiveness. And also, I think he needs to, people, the criticisms with him, are his shot and different areas of his game that he needs to work on, which he's well aware of. So I think we'll see that progression as we go. And then I think definitely during conference season, when he'll be facing like a more consistently good competition on a nightly basis.
Well, you mentioned also on Kansas Embiid, who I've seen a little bit and thought to myself, wow, I wonder, and this is projecting ahead, but thinking like that NBA scout, I'm like, I wonder if he's going to be the best NBA player in 5 years out of this whole class. Where's his sort of skill level right now, just with the game of basketball, and how quickly can he improve?
I mean, I think he's improved really dramatically even this season. I mean, he was one of those guys who's impressing scouts based on practice, in the off season. So I agree. I think him and at Kentucky, you have James Young, and those are two guys who entered the season maybe a little overshadowed by their teammates, but also, at this point, I mean, I haven't looked at mock drafts in a while, but I anticipate are also lottery picks. So, they're those, Embiid's young and raw, but like really, really incredible. And I think you see that whenever you watch a Kansas game, he does catch your eye. I mean, that's another reason, as I was saying with Wiggins, that there are these other weapons on that team, who are capable of taking over a game or stepping up in big moments too. And he's definitely one of them.
So at Kentucky, we've got all these freshmen. But obviously, Julius Randle has been the guy that has gotten the most hype so far. What have you seen, A, from Randle in terms of evaluating where he's at? And then B, the rest of the freshman class, the very, very heralded freshman class, how are they sort of meshing? How are they fitting together? What have you liked? What do you think needs to improve?
I like Julius Randle. I know he struggled against UNC the other day, and I mean, you open the season, he was averaging what, like 20 points and 10 rebounds a game or something for like a stretch. I forget how long he was doing that, but or maybe it was just double doubles, I don't remember, but either way, he was putting up some incredible
I mean,
numbers.
he really did, like, it's a cliche, but he really did look like the man among boys, even though he's like the boy among older men there.
No, he's his build. He's I would not want to go up against him in the paint at all. But so I really like his game. I think he's like really, aggressive and tough and talented. But you know, when he's having these, like when he didn't play well against UNC and you saw a lot of other people struggle in certain areas, it just reminds you how young that Kentucky team is and how, you know, Willie Cauley-Stein, the sophomore, is like their veteran guy, and he's probably been their best player so to this point this season. But they don't have anyone else, like any other veteran guys helping out or around him. I mean, they have Alex Poynters, but like not to the extent, they're not doing what Cauley-Stein's doing. So you have Randall, you have these other freshmen, like the Harrison twins have been getting better. But I mean, those are positions, like Calipari needs his guards to play better. I mean, you see him getting frustrated at careless passing and like little mistakes or drawing up a play and then it not being executed that way. And these are just things that, you know, happen with the young team and young guards. So they need to kind of work on things across the board. They haven't had any bad losses. They've only lost to teams that are ranked, but they do have three losses already. So there's some reason to be concerned with Kentucky, but they're, you know, with all of these teams, and it sound like a broken record just because college basketball is full of freshmen, but everyone's young, so you gotta like, it's almost unfair to start evaluating as people do, you know, after September, or sorry, after November, and then after December. You know, there's just so much,
Right. The
so
team.
these teams grow so much week by week.
You're right. I mean, the teams are going to look so much different even by mid-February than they
Right.
do right now, or even by the end of January. I think you're right. Kentucky's probably one of those teams that, the times I saw them play, in particular, the game I watched the most closely was, it already seems like ancient history, was the Michigan State game, the opening game. But they looked so out of sync. They look like a bunch of talented guys who, like, they look like what they were. They haven't been playing together, basically. It was like almost like watching a pickup game. Where you've got one team that's clearly better, but the other team's a bunch of guys that know each other and have played together for a while. And, you
And
can
that
see
was
the
the night.
difference.
That was the night where the easy storyline was experience trumps, you know, fresh talent. So yes.
Although not, we shouldn't say that Michigan State doesn't have talent, by the way. They always have lots of talent. That's one of
Right.
the big canards in college basketball, is that it's just,
They just have
toughness and Tom Izzo.
the rare breed of a senior, whatever that's like, you know. Some of these teams haven't seen seniors in a while.
Last guy on Arizona, Aaron Gordon. We saw him actually this weekend against Michigan play make some big plays, I thought, sort of in late in that game when Arizona came back and won a very tough road game. This is something, Pete, by the way, I'm going to let you in on a little sort of open secret. I grew up in Tucson. My father's actually a professor at the University of Arizona, so I'm actually pretty familiar with the history there, and I'm pretty familiar with the team. I follow them. It's kind of like the one team in sports I root for, like sort of openly and unabashedly. They look to me like a very complete team right now. Not necessarily, I know they're number one, but not necessarily like a juggernaut team, but a team that just seems to be able to play a lot of styles, can play a lot of different ways, can win in a lot of ways, doesn't have to play well necessarily win. I think a lot will change over the conference season, but what have you seen from them so far? And also from Gordon, in terms of their ceiling and where you think they're going to be come tournament time.
Yeah, I've been really, really high on Arizona as well, especially after seeing them play Duke. Because, like, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, their length and their size is really impressive. But when you see it in person, you're just like kind of taken aback by it. But I really like Gordon. I'm glad you included him in this little, you know, analyzing the top freshman thing, because I think literally just because he didn't play in the Champions Classic, he got like pushed to the side, and it was like the big three. It was Jabari, Wiggins, and Randall. And, you know, but right before he played at the Garden, the preseason NIT, there was a media day, and I just sat at the Arizona table for a few minutes, and I just saw reporters keep coming over and ask Gordon, "So, what's it like not being considered one of the top players?" And then they would leave, and then the next reporter, someone would come by and ask the same question. I just felt so bad for him because, like, he didn't, and he said all the right things, you know, like he didn't care, and it's about his team, blah, blah, blah. But, like, it was literally just because he didn't play that one night in Chicago. All of a sudden, you know, he gets pushed to the side. But again, you know, he probably has the last laugh right now. His team's number one in the country, and I always liked what he would say about how easy the transition was for him for college basketball was because he's got veteran guards. He's got T.J. McConnell, who's the transfer from Duquesne, and Nick Johnson, who has been maybe Arizona's best player so far this season,
I would agree with that. He's
and.
definitely their most consistent player.
Yeah, and important. And so those two guys have made Gordon's transition pretty easy. And you know, Sean Miller is not expecting that much from him. Like we were talking about earlier, he doesn't need to put up huge numbers. He just needs to be consistent. He needs to be rebounding. He needs to be like, a presence. We saw him defend Jabari Parker. We've seen
Right.
him go up against good guys. And so I think, they really are I think the most balanced team in the country. I guess you could make other arguments. I guess Syracuse and Wisconsin have been maybe the two other like very solid teams so far this season. But I'm sold on Arizona. I really like them. I think they're definitely a national title contender. Just because they seem to work so well and they actually have that experience factor. We're talking about like a Michigan State, plus like, this incredible talent now in Aaron Gordon, but they're not a young team and they understand how to work together. And TJ McConnell is, maybe the most underrated player in the country or the most underrated transfer for Sean Miller to have a great point guard like that running that team where he's got so many pieces and talent and scoring options and making it work. So I think I really like, your hometown team. I think it's going to be a good season for them.
Well, I think with Gordon, I would just say two things. One is that he reminds me a little bit of a guy like, again, projecting to that sort of NBA, who's he like in the NBA? It reminds me a little bit of a guy like Sean Marion, who doesn't necessarily need to dominate the ball to have a pretty big impact on the game. It can do a lot of things pretty well. And maybe, and again, maybe isn't as, or no, not maybe, it clearly isn't as sort of one-on-one skilled as a guy like Parker, a guy like Wiggins, maybe isn't doesn't have the ball handling and necessarily the shooting that some of those guys have, but doesn't necessarily need to either. I'm glad you brought up TJ McConnell because to me he's one of those guys where won't probably get a lot of hype, but is probably very indispensable to his team. If he gets hurt, Arizona's gonna have a tough time. If anyone else gets hurt, they're gonna have a tough time, but they can probably paper it over at least for a little while. Wondering from what you've seen so far, who would be your sort of most indispensable player? The guy who maybe, again, isn't necessarily have to be the most hyped guy, but the guy who is, if he's out for any significant piece of time, the team's really going to struggle.
I think TJ McConnell is probably a really good example of that. There are other, I'm trying to think, there are other guys at some of these schools that are more like these veteran experienced guys. I think like, as I was saying, like a Kentucky, if you're a sophomore, you're a veteran. So like Willie Cauley-Stein, if he's not there, Kentucky really struggles because he's the one firing them up. I actually think with Louisville, it might be Montrezl Harrell because I watched them lose to North Carolina and he was in foul trouble for most of the game and he fouled out with about like 7 or 8 minutes left. And when he was off the court, the team just had no energy. Like he was the one firing them up. And so, and also, he's gotten attention. He's a big deal guy, but it's not like Russ Smith. These are the guys, like he's the guy who you got to figure out who, not necessarily, I know people like the term glue guy, but like almost just who the heart of the team is for some of these, where when they're not on the floor, it does make a difference. But there's also a bunch of veteran guys on other top teams that, like if you lose them for a stretch of games, like a CJ Fair, Syracuse or something, then it will take a hit, just because they're so integral to the way the team scores, the team is run, and that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought up Louisville because I feel like for a team that was so successful last year, it almost feels like they haven't gotten a lot of attention so far this year. Does it seem like we're all sort of overlooking them, or what's going on with Louisville?
I think that did happen. As soon as And John Calipari knew that that would happen too. People stopped talking about them losing in the NIT and immediately started getting all excited about the freshman coming. And then all of a sudden, Louisville, who returns Russ Smith and these other guys, no one's really talking about them. But they're still ranked high. Their problem, their schedule. They played North Carolina up in Connecticut, and then they'll play Kentucky this month, but then like their schedule was just not that interesting. It wasn't there. They didn't have a bunch of big games. Like think about Arizona, how many big games they've already played in, and Kentucky and Duke. And there's so much you can watch them, and you watch them against high level competition when you turn them on. And so Louisville hasn't really had that. And then they lost to North Carolina, and everyone thought North Carolina was bad at that point, even though they've been so up and down and they've beaten the good teams. So don't know. I mean, I think we'll see. They should. It'll be interesting to see how conference play works for Louisville because it's their last year in the American. So they really, you know, it's Memphis and UConn and them and I guess Cincinnati and that's kind of it. So they should win the league. But again, Memphis and UConn are really good too. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that shakes out and kind of for those teams, what it's like going through that season in that league for the first time. So we'll have to see with Louisville, but you're right. They definitely are not talked about nearly as much as even the team essentially down the road in
Right.
Kentucky.
Another sort of like Kentucky, another sort of blue blood program, obviously North Carolina. Could, like you said, they've stumbled some, but they've also had some big wins. Could they be a more dangerous team by March than Duke?
I don't know. It's interesting because the you know part of the reason everyone or one of the things everyone's attributing to their kind of up and down season so far is that they're young and you know they've got a lot of sophomores. Marcus Paige has been generally really good for them and he's only a sophomore. And McAdoo has like been hit or miss. So you have these guys who you need to show up for them to play well and do that. But you know, and then they're still obviously waiting the NCAA eligibility decision and PJ Harrison. So that would change things if that's decided and if there's some resolution that somehow works for North Carolina. But I still think that Duke is going to be a completely different team by March as well, as I think, as we were talking about earlier. You know, they have two, their two best players were guys who weren't there last year. So everyone's still trying to get used to each other. And I think they did a better job meshing earlier than, you know, obviously Kansas and or some of these other teams have so far this season. Although they have lost some of their big games, I think if those teams played, you know, again, like Duke plays Arizona in March, it might go a different way. I mean, Arizona is playing like it's March now. I mean,
Sure.
our Pac-12 team coaches were saying that. They're like, they're playing together like it's February because they have an experienced team and they have poise and maturity and stuff. And so the other teams want to be like them. I mean, Coach K has brought that up a few times lately about how they're not Arizona yet. Arizona is, you know, that's what
Right.
schools want to be
So
like right now.
maybe some of these other schools, like they have sort of, Arizona's already hit that point where they're pretty consistent, and some of these other schools, because of youth, are trying to get to that point. So maybe they have got a little more ceiling.
Yes, and so I think that yeah, that would include Duke. So I think like they'll get better by the end of the season. It's kind of a different Coach K team where usually Duke is like really good in November, December, and kind of like maybe plateaus and like stays pretty good, and then you know have a couple losses or whatever or injuries like last year. But this year they were like it's kind of the normal growth where it's like you're young and inexperienced, you lose some games early. And then you have to get better through conference play, like kind of like more normal teams do. And Duke usually
Right.
just like roars through the non-conference.
Like the more normal teams that
Yeah.
are not Duke.
I mean, it's impressive the way Duke, like
Right.
last year, Duke had essentially locked up a really good NCAA tournament seed because they were so good and they beat so many good teams in November, December. And this year is not the case. You know, they dropped some of those games. And so it's kind of a reverse for them.
Well, talking about sort of consistency and inconsistency. To me, so far, the biggest non-surprise of the season is, as usual, Michigan State to me just seem, they just seem like a machine. Like, they're always pretty good. They never seem to have a down year. They always seem to be, like, right there. What's your impression of Michigan State so far? And do you have any sense, like, what is the formula there? How is it that they don't seem to have the sort of ebbs and flows that other programs have?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of it with these teams, and I would put Florida in there too, is that they get guys that stay 3, 4 years. So you don't have that turnover. You have people played together. You have people who are making their natural progressions of like getting better each season, each off season. And like with Florida, and I've talked to Billy Donovan about this, it's like you have mostly those guys, and then they'll sprinkle in, you know, like a Casey Hill, like a guy they think, you know, could be a one and done type talent and is basically ready to go, you know. But you're sprinkling him into a team that has experience and guys that may or may not end up going pro, may try to, maybe by the time they're seniors, could potentially get drafted. You know, these are guys who really developed. And Michigan State does a similar thing. And you have Gary Harris when healthy. And actually, Michigan State seems to not be healthy at all right now.
Right.
But Gary Harris especially, and he's had a variety of injuries over the last 2 years. But when he is healthy, he's right up there with these freshman talents, these Marcus Smarts. Like he can be an incredible explosive player. But you're surrounding him, like even last year when he was a freshman, he was around a lot of juniors and seniors and these guys who had a lot of experience in the Big Ten, which, obviously is one of the best conferences in college basketball. So he was able to succeed as a freshman. And so that's kind of, I think, how they generally do it. And Tom Izzo, installs this sort of toughness, this sort of mentality into his teams each year, and they have a similar identity each year. And the things he always points as like difference makers with like his normally fairly solid teams and like the teams that make Final Fours or the teams that, have competed for national championships are like the emergence of a really good leader. So like Draymond Green was his last like really great leader. Those are things he looks for too, and those are things that also have to develop. But I think this season, I think they'll be okay, but I think right now people are actually sort of jumping off that bandwagon because of how they've looked and how, a couple of their near losses to some bad teams. They think we may have just, gone a little overboard in the off season just because they had guys returning. We got so excited about that, and we may have oversold them a bit. But I think injuries are not helping. And I think they always play well during the Big Ten season.
Right. I like I said, I don't worry about them. I think they'll be totally fine
Yeah.
just because they're always fine. And like they sort of like well, you said to me they have sort of that formula for maybe you don't have as high of a ceiling, but that sustainable success, like you said, where you've already have some upperclassmen, you have some 4-year players, you have sort of that foundation, and then if you can sprinkle in a couple of the talent really talented guys that may not stay that long,
Yeah,
you have a
and plus, I mean, this current group, the seniors have not been to a Final Four, and like under Tom Izzo, every 4-year player has, except this group. So like by history, you'd have to think this team's gonna make a Final Four just because that's how it always works, Michigan
So
State. So.
we'll stay in the Big Ten for a second. What is going on with Wisconsin? Because they're actually scoring points this year. They look like the 2005 Phoenix Suns. I don't understand what I'm seeing. I've spent many a day on Twitter, lamenting Wisconsin's crimes against basketball, but they don't seem to be that same team this year. How do you explain that?
Yeah, when Frank Kaminsky had 41 points and everyone, it was hilarious because obviously, Grinnell College and their system to score, 100 points for one player or whatever. Someone was like, "This is Bo Ryan's answer to Grinnell College, like 41
That's
points."
great.
No, I haven't seen them. I have for whatever reason, I feel like some teams fall through the cracks when I'm trying to watch games, and they've been one. So I've not seen them play a ton this season yet, but I know. It seems like they're playing more aggressively. You get John Gasser back from his injury last year. Sam Decker is playing really well. So you have all these, they always have a good team. Like it's the same with Tom Izzo, Bo Ryan. Like you always know they're going to be an NCAA tournament team no matter what. And even last year, after losing Gasser and like a lot of, turnover, they have turnover every year too. And yet they're just always good. They always have the same identity. You can always tell they're a Bo Ryan coach team, and I know you're saying like they kind of feel different, because maybe they're not winning games like 30-29, but like although they did have that game against Virginia, right? So
That's
that was
true.
a one,
That was a reversion.
yeah, and it might go back to normal also in Big Ten season, because they're really good at getting people to play the way they want to play. So I don't know, but it's kind of funny, and it's a nice little. For the diehard college basketball people to see that a Bo Ryan player scored 41 points is kind of, it's a funny little moment. But I think they're really good. I think they're really well coached. We did a thing earlier this season on the best coaches to not have won a national championship, and obviously Bo Ryan was on that list. So, maybe this is a year that he's got a team where they can actually make a run to do that.
Is there a team out there on the flip side of having being able to make a run that it might not be too early for them to hit the panic button, or that they've really got to turn things around conference play pretty quickly?
So I guess, I think Kentucky fans like to freak out, and I think
They're so spoiled,
they
God.
are. They are. They just won a national
I
championship.
know they had to get rid of all the undefeated season shirts they had printed out for this year too, which I my
Yeah.
favorite story of the year so far. But
Yeah, I think so, I mean, but it's kind of justified because you got to see progress and you sort of see like this team kind of not coming together and they need to start, taking steps forward. And it's hard without, as we were talking about, those veteran guys around them, like they had 2 years ago when they won the title. But one other team, and I don't think they need to press the panic button, but has been a negative surprise, I think, a little bit, is VCU. I think people, me included, thought that Shaka Smart may have his best team yet, and yet, they're having trouble. They lost to FSU, Georgetown, Northern Iowa, and I mean, they're not bad teams, but these are teams, this is a VCU team that was ranked like in the top 15 in preseason polls, and people, I really thought, Shaka Smart's fine, he's got it rolling, he's returning most of his players, but they're having trouble shooting or having a go-to perimeter threat because they lost, players from last season's team. So they're a little bit surprising, and they'll need to turn it around in conference play just because, the A-10 last year was really strong, and obviously still had Butler and Xavier in it too. But this year, they're going to need to kind of run through most of it because you got to pick up the wins against like the St. Louis's, like the good teams in the league, and then, beat everybody else. So they're going to need to do well. I mean, I'm not like worried they're not going to be like a tournament team, but I think they kind of just need to right the ship a little bit and kind of calm down. I mean, I don't think people expected 3 losses already through non-conference play. So, I think they're still a really good team. They're probably still adjusting maybe to some of the foul rule changes because, obviously it affects the way that they play aggressively on defense. So, I don't know. They're just kind of one of the teams. I don't think anyone needs to press the panic button yet, but I think that Kentucky and VCU fans are probably just a little bit nervous as we start to head into conference play.
Well, you mentioned the new rules, the emphasis on calling all the hand checking and arm barring, things like that. Basically, playing defense with your hands, the best way I can say it. That was a big point of emphasis coming this season. There was sort of concern on both sides of it. There was a debate. Some people thought, okay, this is going to make every game into like a free throw fest. It's going to be awful to watch on TV. And I think we did see a few games like that. But I think a lot of other people were saying, look, scoring keeps going down and down and down. We really need to empower offense a little more. This is not really how basketball is supposed to be played in the first place. There's, like I said, there was this debate. What you've seen in the sort of non-conference season so far, where are we with the change of emphasis? Are refs calling the game differently across the board? Is it making for better games? Is it making for worse games? What have you seen?
Yeah, so I don't think, I don't know. I was sort of one of the people who were like, eh, let's wait and see. Let's wait and see if it's still called conference play and that sort of thing. But I did, anticipating that you were going to ask about this, I did look up, NCAA put out some stats last week, and they said that last year there were about 18 fouls per game called, and this year it's 20. And they said it's about an 8% increase in scoring. Obviously, some of that is free throws, but also field goals, made field goals are up this year from last year. So I think I know there are more free throws, and you see it, and you see certain games like Kentucky, North Carolina was a long game, a slow game, kind of ugly game. But there have been not that many. I was worried like at the Champions Classic, you have all these high profile teams and freshmen, you want to see them play, and I thought for the most part we did, and you've had the occasional coach go off on the fouls or the way that it's basically just taking any rhythm out of the game when you have a zillion free throws. But it really, from my experience in games I've watched in person and on TV, it hasn't really impacted me. It hasn't made me turn off the game or get turned off by the pace of the game. I think it was one of those things everyone was very worried about, and then realized that, it's something fixable. You can have your guys just defend with their feet and get to places better.
What a concept, right? Like kind of how you're
Yeah.
supposed to play defense.
And there were coaches who were just like, well, we'll just teach them the new rule. And then there were others who were just like, no, this is so unfair. And so it was like, well, the coaches who clearly just talked to their team and like worked on different defensive drills, like you see that. So I think it's I would much rather watch a game that's in the 70s than in the 60s or 50s or whatever. I like the idea of opening up the game and allowing for more scoring and freedom of movement and stuff. And I think a lot of the coaches do on the whole too. They're upset when their star player gets benched early based on some fouls like this. But I think for the most part, people seem to be okay with it because I don't think it's having this drastic effect on games like people were worried it might.
No, I'm with you. Like, I love it. I think it was very overdue. I remember, look, in the 90s, the Knicks and the NBA with Pat Riley's forced basketball, which was essentially just grabbing, holding. It was like the neutral zone trap of professional basketball, essentially. They almost ruined the NBA from an aesthetic standpoint, those teams. And I know people in New York love them and revere those teams. So let me tell you something, New York. Everyone else in America hated watching those Knicks teams. And their influence on the league cannot be understated. I'm gonna get off my soapbox now, but the point is, I really like that they're trying to open up the college game because I think too much of that was creeping into college basketball. And I agree with you. I mean, this is especially when you're dealing with younger players. This is something you can coach. This is something you can change. You can just tell them, look, you can't hand check as much now. You're gonna have to shuffle your feet more. And there's gonna be, I know coaches hate this, but the game is going to be more open. It's going to be a little more unpredictable. There's going to be more driving. And I think from a fan and spectator standpoint, from a TV watching standpoint, that's good. And also with the free throws, that's great for the networks. They can sell more commercials. So maybe it's not such a bad thing if there are more free throws. One of the things that is always interesting to me in college hoops is when you've got a coach coming in to replace a successful coach. A longtime successful coach or a coach at an iconic program. And I'm thinking of two guys right now in particular. We've got Kevin Ollie at UConn, who again seems like some a little bit under the radar, but seems to be doing a pretty good job of coming in after Calhoun. And then there's also Steve Alford is his first year at UCLA, which was when they made that hire, me being someone that follows Pac-12 pretty closely. There seemed to be a lot of mixed opinion whether that was a good hire or not. From what you've seen at UConn, what you've seen at UCLA, how would you evaluate what those two guys are doing so far?
I think you're right. I think it's always very interesting. I mean, that's what people have talked about, like the guy who had to replace Brad Stevens, Brandon Miller, Butler, and whoever eventually has to replace, Coach K and Roy Williams. Those guys are going to be in those situations too. I've talked to Kevin Ollie quite a bit. I've seen that team play quite a bit this season so far, and I think what helped is Ollie's relationship with Jim Calhoun, who still has an office there and is like, I think his term is like he's a special assistant to someone in the athletic.
Oh, right. One of those emeritus type
Yeah,
positions.
so he's around. I mean, and
I
he's
want one of those jobs so much, by the way. I
right,
want to get paid for what I've already done in life.
but that sort of helps with what you're talking about
Sure.
with pressure and the like someone the being in their shadow when they're there helping you. And I think we saw from the players at UConn last year, they didn't have much to play for at all because they couldn't play in the postseason. So they basically played to give Kevin Ollie the job because he was the interim coach, and they did that around, I think it was around this time last year. And I think they just really bought in. They buy into what he said. I mean, there's a big draw with guys who have NBA experience. Like, I think these college kids love that so much. And with a guy like Kevin Ollie, who had to scrape for it and work really hard for any minutes and any team to make any team in the NBA, like, guys really respect that. So I think he's really, that team, the players really seem to like him and really seem to bought in there. UCLA is a little bit interesting because they had such a strong team coming back. So, it shouldn't really surprise people how well they've started this season. And I think they will play well. They're going to play Duke next week or this week here in New York. So I think you're right. There's these mixed reactions to Alford's hire, but he was very successful at New Mexico. And he's inheriting a really strong team in his first season. So little things that we'll have to see, that people aren't sure about with him, and the concerns about can he recruit LA and Southern California and different things like that, or manage, there's obviously a lot of attention and boosters and people, there's pressure at UCLA that there wasn't at New Mexico. That stuff, I think we're gonna actually have to wait a couple years to see how all of that stuff plays out. But this season, clearly, he was able to, as coaches say, they re-recruit the players who are there when you take over a new program, get them to get on the same page as you, and let their talents and their their strengths shine. So I think they've been able to do that. And if as everyone says, winning cures everything. So whatever concerns and doubters there were with the initial hire, if he has a strong season this year, it'll be a lot quieter. So I think both those schools are very interesting situations to keep an eye on. And I would add Butler's just to the list, although I don't think there's much expected of that program this year. They obviously you lose your best player to a suspending injury and moving to the Big East and all of that. But I think Brandon Miller's another guy who's in a position like you're mentioning.
Just a quick note on the UCLA thing. I just think you're so right from the standpoint of whoever takes that job, it is the hard part is probably dealing with the media and the alumni and the expectations because talent-wise, the idea of, well, can he recruit or not recruit? I mean, I feel like UCLA, at least in my lifetime, like even in their worst season has at least one or two guys that are probably going to play in the NBA at some point. Like they're like North Carolina. It doesn't really matter in terms of you're going to get talent. It's a question of can you do enough with it. Speaking of Los Angeles, one last question about new coaches and new places. My most interesting man in college basketball, Andy Enfield, our friend from Florida Gulf Coast last year, who has already gotten to some media spats with some other coaches and just seems to be doing something interesting down at USC, which is obviously traditionally a football school. I guess they had our the Tim Floyd era. I'm not really sure if that counted for much, but what is his team? What do they look like so far? What do you think he can do with that program? And they've got a really nice arena. They're obviously in Southern California, and potentially, it seems like they could be a fairly decent basketball school. How's that fit looking right now? And what do you expect in the next couple of years?
This season's gonna be rough. They're gonna as they have been, they're gonna lose a lot of games. But I think that city is such a hard place to play college basketball. I mean, if you think about all the other things that people could pay attention to and go to, I mean, you've got two pro basketball teams, you've got other pro sports, you've got the beach, you've got Hollywood. There's a lot. So if you're UCLA, at least you have this history, you have this something that kind of harken back to, and if you get good again, it brings back all of this stuff and the name brand and stuff. So Andy Enfield has a challenge of not having that and having to essentially build from scratch. But you're right. I mean, you have if you are good, if you somehow become the show in LA, which he's trying to do, and like you've heard him and Alford say it, but obviously, Enfield has shown it with Florida Gulf Coast that playing fast and exciting and wanting to get people to come and watch that. So that's, how you try to draw fans and get attention and things like that. And he's shown he can recruit. And so you got to get, it's going to take some time because you got to get the talented players, that are not just, you need to get like some of the best players in the Pac-12 so that you're competing for a league title, which means that you're relevant nationally, sort of thing. But like I said, I mean, that's just a tough job to come into and tough place to
I
try
mean,
to win just because there's so much else going on. So
to be really successful in LA, you almost have to have an element of glamour to your team and to your program. You can't be Bill Ryan, Wisconsin. You can't be Michigan State. I mean, I guess maybe you could have someone like Calipari, like what he's doing in Kentucky. Kentucky sort of has the glamour factor in college basketball right now. I mean, is that
they also
I don't think of glamour when I think of college basketball. So it seems like that's almost like a tougher challenge than most coaches would face.
Yeah, but also, I mean, even with Calipari, like they're Kentucky and college basketball in that state is the thing. Like, you're not competing with other things going on. And yes, he can bring in celebrities and all that stuff and gets lots of attention, but it's not like he was competing against. He doesn't have an NBA team like next door that he's also trying to compete with. They're the show in town. So yeah, there's that stuff with USC, and you're right. There's certain coaches who've been successful. Like, I mean, I'm thinking of Billy Donovan at Florida at football schools. You have to, it's harder to try to get people to, pay attention to basketball and really get into it. But you can use football to bring your recruits on big football weekends. Like there are ways to that they can help each other. In Michigan, obviously, last year, traditionally a football program school, and now the basketball program is on the rise too. So you have examples where, it can be done, but again, It's going to be a challenge. It's going to be hard, and it's going to be harder than Steve Alford's job at UCLA, I think, just because you're basically starting from scratch.
I want to ask you about the O'Bannon case. Now, obviously, I know you're covering college basketball from the on the court standpoint a lot of times, but I'm sure, as this case has gone through the court system, I'm sure people in college basketball are talking about it, are thinking about it. You don't have to name any names, but I'm curious, even in the kind of off the record conversations you've had with people, how concerned or interested are coaches and their people in college basketball about this case and sort of what it might mean for the future of the NCAA, amateurism, what their jobs are going to entail or not entail. Do you get a sense for where people are on this?
So, and this is not something that like comes up all the time, but in my limited interaction with coaches on the subject, I don't know how many of them are following it that closely. I mean, there have been lots of incremental updates, so sort of checking in with people after those, like, they're not following it as closely. Obviously, they know what's going on, generally speaking, and they have been asked a lot about issues related to pay for play. And that sort of thing over the last few months, obviously, because it kind of, I guess Johnny Manziel was kind of when it started to really kind of take off and take on a life of its own, that idea. But I think you hear more and more people paying attention and closely paying attention and figuring out what it's going to mean from a lot of, like, athletic directors and people who and commissioners and those people on that side of, like, the more on the business side of sports. And most of them are essentially saying, we just got to wait and see what happens because they can't really do anything now. They have to wait to see when it's all resolved, what it's going to mean, and what changes, if any, they're going to have to make. So I think people are kind of in a wait and see mode. But again, and I think coaches are too, but I don't think there's so little that they could even control and or do in this situation besides wait. So I think that's essentially what they're doing. Sorry, I don't have any
No, do you, I mean, do you get a
though,
sense?
but I think that's just how they have to think about it.
Well, you don't have to apologize. I'm curious, do you think, just knowing coaches like you do, I mean, do you think that they would look if O'Bannon wins or amateurism is done away with, it obviously would refract would change and affect how they recruit. But would it change a coach's job that much? Like, do you think they would really care one way or another if the players were getting a bigger cut or not getting a bigger cut?
I'm not sure. I think that would probably be up to each person and
Right.
individually, and I don't know. And I think there've been maybe some coaches who've kind of talked about things along those lines. But it's hard because coaches, even when you talk about transfer rules and how coaches can leave jobs and this and that, there's a lot of, like, that going on. And I don't know if coaches always want to speak so candidly about things like that, because they can kind of be grouped in, or some of these coaches were former players who went through the system as well.
Oh, yeah,
So,
for sure. Yeah, I don't think they want to speak very candidly if they can avoid it. I
right,
remember.
especially about this stuff, just because it's a little bit, it's just messy. So I think that's why we don't hear that much from them, or even when we do, it's very, like, cautious.
Oh, yeah, no, in the spring, I can remember I was asking a pretty, I can't name who it is, but I was asking a pretty major, Division I basketball coach, off the record about sort of how they felt about the economic setup in college sports. Was it fair? What would be right for the players? And this person gave me a 5-minute soliloquy on why it was unfair, why it should change, why the players should get something more. And like I said, it was very thoughtful. At the end of it, I asked him, I'm like, so, what would it take for you to actually say that publicly instead of just sort of off the record to me? And he's like, well, maybe if I won 3 or 4 national championships. I was like, oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Which I think you're right. I mean, nobody really wants to rock the boat, or and the dreaded sports word distraction always comes up. Nobody wants that. One related question, which is, I'm somebody, as a columnist, I write a lot of bomb throwing pieces about the NCAA. We've seen Jay Billis over at ESPN like loudly and publicly call them out. I think he's almost used his bully pulpit there. And you could see that this actually does get under the skin of people like NCAA President Mark Emmert. He actually mentioned Jay Billis last week at a event in New York where he and some conference commissioners were talking about a lot of this. I believe you were at that event, right?
Yep.
Do we as angry columnists make your job as a beat reporter harder?
I don't think so.
Okay, few.
I mean, I think it's not like, I mean, these people, the Mark Emmerichs, the commissioners, everyone, I don't know. I mean, I think that they deal with certain people and they, I don't know. I mean, Mark Emmer, frustrations that come out of Jay Bilas, it could be, from a lot of things boiling up. Who knows? I mean, he was getting a lot of questions about a lot of different things and a lot of tough subjects, including Miami and stuff. So, different things I think set people off. But I don't know. I mean, they know who they're dealing with, and if you're talking to someone and one of their coworkers wrote something or whatever. I mean, you've seen Mark Emmer and Dennis Dodd of CBS, like they had a little heated
Right, they
exchange at
did.
the Final Four, and so but they still, like Dennis can ask him questions. Like it's professional. You don't understand what people's jobs are. And they understand, like we understand what their job is. So, I mean, I think it's just like kind of a normal. It's a tough situation because you've got litigation going on. You've got a lot of different issues affecting the sport and their jobs right now. So, I think it just sort of there's a lot going on. But I think both sides understand each other's jobs. And if like all writers were given the NCAA pass on everything, like that wouldn't work. And if everyone was only hammering them and not giving them a chance to respond or do what you should do, then that would be a problem. So I think there's a balance, but it's just such a messy time for college sports right now that you have these tensions and these comments like Mark Emmert, Jay Billis, you have that happen.
Right. Well, look, I think we are pretty much out of time here. So, Nicole Auerbach, USA Today Sports, thank you so much for coming on. Are there any big stories you've got cooking that we should be looking for soon?
I'll keep you posted. I'm not going to give anything away on the podcast. But
Okay, so it's secret stories. You don't want to get scooped.
nothing too secret. But
I was hoping for some scandal, though.
no, not at the moment.
Will you come back on maybe when we're about halfway through or maybe three quarters of the way through conference season to give us an update? Or definitely at least before the tournament?
Sure.
Awesome. And in the meantime, how can people follow you on Twitter?
Just follow my name, Nicole Auerbach, NicoleAuerbach.
Have to ask any relation to the legendary basketball coach?
I get that a
I
lot.
know you must, so I have to put it out there.
Well, and so my grandmother always said yes, but my dad and uncle were like, no, it's not really. But I just need to start going with it because I get asked by a lot of college basketball coaches, and like, I think they would like me a lot better. I think they'd be like, oh, wow, this is like Red's granddaughter or something. So, I might just start saying yes and see what happens.
I think you need to go with that too. But you shouldn't see you should have just you have to start the lie now. You shouldn't have told me the
Right,
truth on a podcast. Now
I
now the dozens of people who listen are gonna know.
know. Yeah, I need to come up with a plan of attack for this, for going along with it.
Well, terrific. Look, again, this has been Nicole Auerbach, USA Today Sports college basketball writer. And if you follow college hoops, you definitely need to read her. That's all the time we have for today. So for Sports on Earth, I'm Patrick Ruby, saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.